This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Greg Jones. Greg is CEO of Strategic Applications, a global crisis management company, and an adjunct professor for Georgetown's most important master's program, the School of Foreign Services Security Studies program. And full disclosure, I am a student in the program, but we promise that I'm not currently a student in Greg's class. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Maggie. It's a pleasure to be here.
So crisis management is a term that gets thrown around a lot in D.C., and no one seems to really know what it means. So that's probably a good place for us to start, as well as how did you end up in crisis management and in how has it changed?
Crisis management and crisis in general is a term that is widely used in the Washington environment, and it means different things to many different people. How I became involved with it most significantly was in the months after 9/11. I found myself in the office of the Secretary of Defense, and we were grappling with what we came to understand needed to be crisis management processes. One of the issues that we grappled with was that the organization was structured to operate very effectively on the day-to-day, but when the unexpected event came rolling down the street at us, we did many things as if it were the first time from a process perspective. We used a highly scientific and technical term that we were completely caught up in ad hocery. And so we decided that at some point that was suboptimal, that we were spending too much time with each new event starting again, reinventing the wheel. So we took it upon ourselves to try to develop processes that sought to identify the routine in each crisis, the things we could expect to confront, and then routinize the routine. Take the ad hocery, take the unexpected out of what we could. Now, frequently, a crisis will come at you from unexpected directions and have many unexpected characteristics. It is probably a pointless exercise to anticipate or attempt to anticipate every scenario. You'll never finish that list. But what you can do is you can organize your own information and decision-making processes so that whatever the character of the crisis of the day, you have at least taken the first steps to absorb the unexpected and to prepare yourself to respond to the event.
So what makes a crisis different from day-to-day life at OSD, right? Because that's a place where a lot happens in a given day.
One could say that a lot is happening in our world now, day-to-day, and everywhere. Certainly OSD has that experience, but I think the pace and rapidity of events today in our modern world has put a crisis on pretty much any organization's plate with regularity. As to what makes a crisis different, that was a question we asked ourselves with a fair degree of precision to try to isolate what we could do to be better prepared. And here are some of the things that we decided made a crisis different from just a busy day. A crisis is rapid onset. It develops, or it is breaking news, if you want to use that kind of terminology, very quickly. It dominates your attention and your organization's attention rapidly. It is, to some degree, unexpected. Now, while you may have been expecting something like it for a while, the exact dynamics or the exact timing of the event on your organization will be largely unexpected. You didn't necessarily expect to confront it today. Additionally, it's typically a high-consequence event. The stakes are high. If the organization and the individuals who lead it do not react well or correctly, there will be perceptions of ineffectiveness or perceptions of inefficiency and maybe some finger-pointing later on. Another feature is the outcome or the direction of the final act in the play is unclear at the start. You really can't often predict where the event is going to end up, how long the event will run, what the costs in casualties or organizational damage might be. These events have emotional and cultural impacts often. People who are observing them or who are affected by them are forced to take aboard emotional burdens that run from perhaps fear for personal danger or personal effects if they're close by, to simply the anxiety at the further end of the spectrum, the anxiety of the uncertainty that the constant drumbeat of media development may impose upon them. These kinds of events test the resiliency and the preparedness of the organization. It tests the leadership. It because of the uncertainty, it tests the efficacy of the management structures. It tests the capacity of the individuals who comprise the organization to deal with it. And all of those things are non-routine. Many people work in high tempo or high stress job or organizational environments. But the kind of features that I just listed are a different level of uncertainty, anxiety, and consequence.
And I think that's an important distinction, right? Especially when we're talking about in the context of security, where everything may feel or seem or to the untrained eye look like a crisis. It is, in fact, not always a crisis. And there is skill and value in being able to determine what is a crisis and what is not a crisis, because responding correctly to a crisis is clearly, as we're going to talk about, important. But if you respond to something like it is a crisis and it is not, in fact, a crisis, there are implications for that as well, right?
Yes, there are. And there are certainly cost-benefit trade-offs. And leadership of organizations, regardless of whether a governmental or a corporate organization, when confronted by one of these events, indeed, one of their first challenges is often to determine the classic, what's going on? What's really happening here? And how serious is it? How serious might it be for the health of the organization, for the people who comprise it, for the organization's function? If it's a government organization, for the DOD mission, what's the effect on the national security of the United States? If it's a corporate organization, what is the effect on our brand, our public image, our employees, and so on? So the leadership's initial assessment and ability to assess rapidly and accurately is certainly at a premium.
So these are all skills on how an organization can be not just more resilient, or I guess a more specific part of that, but kind of how to respond to a crisis appropriately and as efficiently as possible. And some organizations do that better than others. I'm thinking of some that do it pretty well and others that do it less well. How do you think, I don't know if it's fair to ask in the entirety of USG, right? How does USG respond to crises? Because that's not necessarily a fair question, right? When you're looking at DOD versus DHS versus state. So when you assess how the government responds to a crisis, do you say a whole of government, or are you talking more specifically about DOD mission, that kind of thing?
It might be helpful to start more or less at kind of the first principles level. Organizations today, be they government or corporate or nonprofit, are designed in a hierarchical fashion. There is a line and block chart with a collection or an individual at the top, and then functions are subdivided down some number of layers. And all of those organizational structures are designed, they're actually optimized for the day-to-day. They are specifically constructed to make the mission of the organization run as smoothly as possible. Now, of course, some are more effective or efficient, some get more lean, some get more fat, but all organizations in the kind of the modern context are put together that way, with the exception of some of the technology startups that are operating in a different mode. But generally speaking, certainly for government, you have a hierarchical structure. Nowhere in there is there an optimization for crisis. Nowhere in there is there the agility, if you want to use a term of art today, to pivot, to address the immediate high consequence, oh my gosh, things are really bad kind of an event. So when you ask about are organizations more prepared or which organizations are more prepared, the general reaction is that very few organizations are prepared in the sense that they're not optimized for crisis. If you think about it, organizations like, well, let's use a fire department. Mm-hmm. That is an organizational structure and type that is optimized for speed of response. Mm-hmm. And it's an entirely different approach to how they do their day-to-day than a large government bureaucracy or a large corporate bureaucracy of any type. So the challenge then, and what I try to do in my work, is to help organizational leadership teams take just a few moments out of the big picture, in reality maybe a few hours a year, and think about how they would pivot to handle a crisis. If it's a corporate organization, suddenly your primary product has an E. coli problem, if you're a food product. Or if you're building cars, suddenly you have a safety recall that is going to cause you to reverse your product line for an extended period of time. If you're a government organization, a key element of your service to the nation is suddenly called into question or at risk. So if you can help the senior leadership team envision how, and here's the hard part sometimes, who specifically within their leadership team will be responsible for taking care of the crisis. If you can lead them through that mental, and it's fairly brief, mental journey, and help them envision it, and then come back sometime later, 6 months, a year, help them envision it again, it's incredibly productive. It does take the ad hocery, to go back to my earlier term, it takes the ad hocery out of it, and it takes the leadership team to a level of more or less a subconscious preparedness confidence. They know that, okay, I've thought this through, and if the bad day happens, I won't be, for some brief amount of time, hopefully not too long, caught like a deer in the headlights trying to figure out what to do.
Right. And you made an important distinction between not just what to do, but who to do it, as well as pointing out in the case of a fire department, you know, they are built for speed of response. But speed of response doesn't necessarily mean you're really good at dealing with a crisis, right? You can be really fast to respond, but your response could be pretty terrible. So how do you balance, you know, building a system that knows how to start acting versus what their action should be?
Very perceptive question. Where I try to start when I'm working with people in organizations is I try to focus on that first step of the who. If we can identify who your crisis leadership team will be, often that helps answer some of the follow-on questions. Now, here's what I mean by that. Let's put it in a corporate setting for the sake of discussion. If you're in a corporate C-suite kind of a setting, you are generally going to want somewhere between 4 to maybe 10 individuals around you if suddenly your brand safety is called into question and the company that you've spent decades building is suddenly on the way to becoming an evening talk show joke. Mm-hmm. You're going to want a small group of trusted advisors to help you through that if you're the CEO of that organization. Typically, there are at least two skills you know you're going to need in almost every situation. You're going to need your general counsel. You're going to need legal advice as to what your legal authorities and your responsibilities and your limitations are. And that is also true in government. We always found ourselves in government settings wanting the general counsel in the room. Right. Regulatory and statutory limitations and responsibilities are a very important part of whatever you're going to try to accomplish. So that's one. You always want some sort of senior experience legal advice on the team. Another element you're going to want on the team is some degree of practiced, maybe familiar, public relations, public communications, spokesperson functionality. Mm-hmm. You want your organization to be well represented and frequently represented in the media. Now, whether that's a government department or a corporation, you want your story and your knowledge of the facts and what you're doing about the event to be clearly and regularly presented. So thinking through, now I'm going back to my example of being a CEO, thinking through who those individuals specifically will be with those skills by name is a very important first step. Then you probably are also going to want someone in the operations element of your larger effort. Now, maybe that's a chief operating officer in a government setting. Maybe that's a combatant commander. But someone who is a knowledgeable, experienced, and very well-connected advisor about your core mission. After that, your team is probably best comprised of close personal advisors or just smart people who will provide options and provide pros and cons about the options, make you aware of pitfalls that you may not be thinking of in your senior leadership role, and can speak with you frankly about how this whole thing is going. Because as the pace of events accelerates, if they do, it will be increasingly challenging to maintain perspective. So now what we've gotten to here now is, for the sake of discussion, is a crisis team of trusted advisors, and let's say there are six of them that are identified. Now you've got two important things to do before you pat yourself on the back and say you're ready. The first is to make each of those individuals individually and personally aware that they are on the crisis
team.
That
seems like a really important thing to do.
It's a pretty important thing, and it's astonishing sometimes how often those sorts of very basic, clear communications are assumed or get lost in administrative emails or memos or whatever. So literally saying to your, if it's your general counsel, I want you to know that on a bad day, I want you in the conference room with me. It only takes a minute, but it's important. Then the next dynamic is to also make sure that each one of those six crisis team members has an identified backup. Because if the general counsel is just happened to pick the bad day to be recovering from major surgery and can't be in the conference room, you're still going to need the legal advice. So it's important that there's the identified crisis team and then a backup individual for each one of those positions. By simply doing those steps or those measures, you have gone, as a leader, miles beyond where many organizations actually operate today.
Well, that's terrifying.
It is troubling. But many organizations would do what I just described after the event, after the breaking news has hit the cable news networks.
Rather wasteful.
And so they spend time finding the right person in media relations. They spend time discovering that, oh my gosh, my general counsel is recovering from surgery today. Who's the next? Who's most knowledgeable? And all of those time expenditures are also moments ticking away when the event is developing. And it may be improving or it may not be, but the event is developing regardless of how with what degree of agility you're responding to it. So if you lose time doing those basics and you raise your own anxiety level as a leader getting those basics done, you're actually losing ground on the event.
Right.
The event is accelerating away from you. So now in my example, we've established this crisis team. Well, what can we do next to get a bit ready? Well, spend 30 minutes or an hour in the conference room together once a year, envisioning how you will interact with one another on a bad day. Don't try to envision every scenario. Just pick one scenario. And we've all been deluged by a wide variety of potential candidate scenarios in the past months and years. Our world is becoming significantly more crisis-laden. So it's easy to pick one, and then just merely use it. Don't become immersed in the details so much as use it as a venue to talk with one another as a crisis team about what you would expect from one another, and help each member envision their part of the role that they would be expected to play. To continue my example of the media relations person. Well, the media relations person would be probably scheduling press conferences. How is that done? Would be reaching out to correspondents that they have perhaps closer relationships with than others to be giving background briefings. Would be gathering their own data from Reuters and other news sources to see what the media is saying. Helping all of those things just get articulated, and those are just very basic examples, but get articulated in a sense of urgency and in a sense of taking control of the situation is an important dynamic for a crisis team that has just sat down in that kind of a context in a conference room for the first time to have that kind of a dialogue. And then at the conclusion of that, okay, now maybe you've spent an hour to 2 hours, the crisis team, knowing that and having that in their kit bags, can go back to their normal functions and roles. And then I would recommend that revisit that activity certainly at least once a year, because personalities will change. You will have people who will move on from those positions. You may need to replace a position. At some level, you want to just refresh.
Yeah.
You want to address the fact that, I don't know, maybe the corporation bought a new subsidiary in the intervening time frame, and that new subsidiary has a headquarters in a high-risk country. So that's something that may need to be brought into the dialogue. I don't particularly advocate that crisis management training needs to become the new most important thing you do. I just think it needs to be one of the things that you do, but that it's regular and it is done. It is. It's going to save potentially lives and certainly anxiety in the end.
So when you think about where we, and I say we as, you know, either DOD or USG, where the U.S. government was, let's say, in 2000 and where it is now, is it a more resilient system? Is it managing crises better, less well?
It's hard to judge. And this is purely a subjective personal opinion, of course, and it is able to be refuted by people closer to the problems today than I am. But I think some things are indeed better. I think some things are worse. What is better is that information technologies have now become more robust and well embedded and are generally more widely used and understood as tools that permit rapid dialogue and that permit the ability to gather situational information with a degree of precision that we certainly did not enjoy 15 years ago. That is better. Another thing that is better is that the simple and often painful drumbeat of events has made crisis awareness and event awareness a more common thing across the government, and therefore individuals in offices are better at it. They mm-hmm. have, by and large, absorbed a wide array of lessons and have profited from that. The thing that is, I think, I can't say it's worse, but I think it's worth paying attention to, is that some of the harder lessons from maybe a decade ago are now in dusty three-ring binders and have not necessarily been consulted by the individuals who have now taken the positions mm-hmm. because of skill and personnel turnover. Time passes and new people take the jobs that the people who lived through the crises once held. So it is a very sobering experience, and I've observed it personally. It's a very sobering experience for senior civilian officials, for example, within the Defense Department, to be confronted by their first event when, in fact, their advice will save lives or maybe cost lives. Mm. It is a very sobering thing for those individuals to confront, and there is almost there are very few ways to prepare for it.
Right.
But one of the ways to prepare for it is to, first of all, acknowledge that it will probably occur on your watch again, whatever the event is. To talk to some of the older hands who have maybe been around and been through it. And be aware that that on that day, it will almost certainly be the unexpected thing. Whatever you had planned for that week suddenly won't matter. And if whether it's a hurricane that devastates New Orleans or whether it's a an attack in Paris that has a terrorist nexus, or whatever the event may be that confronts your schedule that day, it will land on you without warning, and suddenly, as the senior official, your personal input and your personal action will matter a great deal. And so preparing for that as best you can individually, and then preparing the people around you to be able to support you is just a non-trivial matter.
Well, Greg, this brings us to our last question, which is, of course, always, what's next?
What's next?
So, Greg, what's next? And what's the world going to look like in 20 years?
It's a sobering, I've been using that word a lot, I note. An outlook that I can't say is incredibly optimistic. I am concerned about the degree of fragmentation and the degree of geopolitical effects and multilateral effects we're seeing around the world. The frequency of bad events is certainly increasing. The costs of bad events in lives and treasure is certainly increasing. Whether it's the effects of climate change that we can only begin to codify, to the fact that security structures and alliances are being tested, arguably like they haven't been tested for decades, all of those things cause me to be very concerned about the overall trajectory of where we are headed. The good news is there are empowering technologies, and there is empowering science, and there is the ability for populations and organizations to adapt if they choose to. I guess I would close by saying the hierarchical classic organization, generally speaking, needs to adapt. And large-scale bureaucracies, be they government, corporate, private, large-scale bureaucracies are finding themselves threatened into irrelevancy because of their just slow adaptation cycles. The organizations that I think will survive and thrive in the future must become agile, and they must become populated by individuals who think in agile terms. And that is, I think, going to be demanded of them. And otherwise, the classic organizational models of the World War II era will simply become historical footnotes.
Of the World War II era.
Of the World War II era.
Well, Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Maggie. It's been a privilege.
This is What's Next. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch.